Senate recess will come to order Thursday, March the 29th. Time is 4:09. We have a full committee today. Senator Stedman, Stevens, Green, McGuire, Wilikowski, Wagner, and myself, Huggins. We have with us today, addressing the subject of natural gas pipeline projects, Senate Bill 104, Mid-America's subsidiary, Kern River Transmission Company. Mr. Kirk Morgan is the president. And Mr. Morgan, if you would come forward, put yourself on the record, and just so you understand our perspective on this, is that when we hear you speak, we hear Mid-America speak. If that's not true, tell me that.
It's absolutely true.
Okay. And but before you put yourself on the record, there's a couple of other things that I will mention to members. Number one, you should have a number of items that are from BP. It has BP's logo on the front, dated March 29th, which is answers to some questions. Read those on your own time, and we can talk about those tomorrow. And before we hear from our presenter today, I'll go back and review a question that was asked of TransCanada, and then we talked about that subsequent. And just this is from the transcript when TransCanada came to see us, and it was the question. I tell you what, I'm going to hold off on that until we hear your testimony, so we don't influence your perspective, and then we'll revisit that. Okay, with that, put yourself on the record, and we'll be proud to hear from you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to testify to this committee on behalf of Mid-American Energy Holdings Company concerning the proposed Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. My name is Kirk Morgan. I am the president of Kern River Gas Transmission Company, a wholly owned subsidiary of Mid-American Energy Holdings Company. Mid-American has assets totaling $37 billion and an employee base of 18,000. Mid-American, through Kern River and its sister company, Northern Natural Gas, owns and operates more than 17,500 miles of interstate natural gas transmission pipelines with a combined capacity exceeding 6.4 billion cubic feet per day. Mid-American's pipelines deliver approximately 8.3% of the natural gas delivered in the United States. The Kern River Pipeline, which our company built in 1991, brings natural gas from the Rocky Mountain supply basins across 926 miles of rugged mountainous and remote desert terrain to customers in Utah, Nevada, and California. Kern River was the largest gas pipeline project to have been built in the United States in more than a decade. In 2003, Kern River expanded the pipeline, more than doubling its capacity, adding 717 miles of 36-inch and 42-inch diameter pipeline. The $1.2 billion project was completed on time, $87 million under budget, and helped restore stability to energy markets in the western United States. Mid-American is a subsidiary of Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated. Berkshire is one of only a few companies in the world with a AAA credit rating. Berkshire has a market capitalization in excess of $160 billion. It is recognized worldwide for financial strength, investment acumen, and integrity. The development of Alaska's huge natural gas reserves is essential to both Alaska and the United States. Projected market growth, combined with a decline in North American production, has created a growing supply-demand imbalance that cannot be adequately addressed by traditional gas supply basins alone. Alaska's natural gas is needed to help ensure energy security, reliability, and price stability in the United States. The Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline project is unprecedented in its scale and complexity. The successful development of the project will require an alignment of stakeholder interests, including the state of Alaska, the North Slope producers, future North Slope explorers and producers, a pipeline developer, shippers, and the federal government. Projects of this scale can easily be delayed, and that has been the history of this project. Only through proper planning, organization, and execution can the project achieve its goals to accelerate development of Alaska's natural gas resources and transport gas to the lower 48 markets at the lowest reasonable cost. To do otherwise will relegate this project and development of this resource to reacting to the next energy crisis, where goals are frequently compromised in the interest of expediency. Mid-American has a serious interest in developing this project in a manner that is consistent with the state of Alaska's interests. From our perspective, the negotiations conducted by the previous administration under the Stranded Gas Act were not fruitful for many reasons. Foremost among these were that they produced proposals not supported by the people of the state. They failed to give serious consideration to alternative proposals for development, and they consumed years without advancing the project. We believe that AGEA is a positive step towards revitalizing the gas pipeline development process in a way that will move the project forward. The bill will allow consideration of competing proposals and ideas for developing the pipeline, and the state benefits from such competition. The bill offers positive inducements to those who have already discovered gas to commit to the pipeline, while defining tariff provisions that will encourage new exploration. And the bill offers inducements to a pipeline developer to advance the project in a manner that the state defines as in its best interest. Perhaps most importantly, the bill establishes a process where each party that proposes to develop the line must make meaningful commitments to development milestones for the legislature and the public to see what it will and will not do and by what dates. AGEA is a good first step. AGEA is an open, transparent, and competitive process designed to advance the project on a deliberate schedule and in a manner that achieves the overarching goals of the state, which are to, one, encourage new exploration on the North Slope, two, provide for expansion of the pipeline as new reserves are brought into production, three, to achieve the lowest cost, commercially reasonable tariff, four, to create jobs for Alaskan, and five, to provide natural gas to Alaskans for in-state use. AGEA recognizes the magnitude of the front-end development risks and offers to share that risk in a significant way by offering dollar-for-dollar matching of initial development expenditures, by offering worker training for Alaskans, and by committing to expedite state permitting requirements. These, plus separate inducements offered to resource owners, are significant commitments which signal to the marketplace that the project is moving on a serious and credible path towards completion. In the absence of such progress, markets will have no alternative than to seek other means to meet market demand. The most significant alternative would be to allow imported LNG even greater market access, uncontested by the development of Alaska's natural gas resources. While LNG is certainly a necessary part of the natural gas resource mix, it makes little policy sense to unnecessarily increase our reliance on foreign energy from many unstable and unpredictable regions around the world. This project, in Mid-American's view, is undeniably necessary, and the time is now to push it forward. The key to moving the project forward is to determine the appropriate balance of risks and rewards for all stakeholders. There is an alternate approach. The North Slope producers have for years articulated their must-haves before advancing the project. You've heard these prerequisites before, including one, tax and royalty certainty on gas and on oil, two, regulatory certainty in both the U.S. and Canada, three, cost reductions through technological advancements, and four, federal enabling legislation. This approach is effectively saying that the project will get started if and when all the preconditions have been met and all concessions have been extracted. This approach has proven to be ineffective in advancing the project. Mid-American's approach is different. We believe that the project can be advanced concurrent with resolutions of issues that today remain outstanding. I want to emphasize that MidAmerican's view that alignment of stakeholder interests is essential. Parties will understandably act in their self-interest and in their own business interest. That is why stakeholder alignment is critical to a successful project. That alignment must clearly set forth the roles and responsibilities of each party, as well as the commercial structure, which will balance the risks and rewards such that investment expectations will be known up front. Our approach does not exclude interested parties or discount new ideas which may be offered to help manage project risks. We know that if a pipeline is developed by an independent developer, the North Slope producers will play the critical role as shippers on the line and sellers of gas to other shippers. MidAmerican is an independent pipeline, is impartial, and is in a unique position to help facilitate solutions when stakeholders' interests diverge. We are confident that an appropriate capital structure and rate design, coupled with our low cost of capital and project experience, can result in a project structure with appropriate allocations of risk and reward for all stakeholders, including the state of Alaska and the producers. Indeed, MidAmerican believes that an independent pipeline provides the best alignment of interests. National energy policy promotes, in fact requires, competition and unbundling of market segments. For example, the market structure in the United States typically requires that exploration and production, interstate transportation, marketing, and distribution be performed by separate companies. Competition, not market concentration, will lead to efficient markets. MidAmerican has no upstream, downstream, or global commercial interests that would create any conflict of interest or raise any type of market power concern with respect to this project. Accordingly, MidAmerican's interests align extremely well with the state of Alaska and include, one, accelerating development of this critically important project. Two, achieving the lowest cost commercially reasonable tariff. Three, offering a commercial structure that encourages new exploration and production to both expand and extend the life of the pipeline. 35 trillion cubic feet, the amount of proven reserves, implies only a 22-year project life, and new discoveries are critical to fill the pipeline over its useful life. Four, providing open access, non-discriminatory transportation services to ensure both receipts and deliveries are provided for in-state use. And five, ensuring Alaskan jobs and workforce development. The state's commitment to workforce training and development is extremely important. Skilled labor shortage is one of the contributing factors in construction cost increases throughout the industry. A skilled Alaskan workforce will not only ensure jobs for Alaskans, but will help address an industry-wide demand for these workers. The process set forth in AGEA will allow these ideas and all parties' ideas and proposals to be advanced and tested in an open and transparent manner. We support that process. And while we can understand the debate over what constitutes the best pipeline development proposal, it's harder to understand why parties would object to a process that calls for an open and transparent comparison of proposals. We urge the legislature to approve this legislation this session so that a pipeline developer can be selected in a time frame that will allow a productive 2008 field season for engineering and environmental programs to be conducted. That concludes my prepared testimony. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today, and I'd be happy to address any questions you may have.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Morgan. Do you have any other people that are accompanying you today representing Kern River?
Nobody representing Kern River.
Okay, or?
Or MidAmerican.
Okay, good. Thank you. Senator Wagner.
Yeah, I got several questions. The first one is, we've heard testimony from the producers, other pipeline companies. What would be your vision of the pipeline that you would build if selected? Would you build to the hub in Alberta? Would you build through to Chicago? What kind of thoughts have gone into your planning for presenting to the state of Alaska in your proposal?
Yes, when we first came up to Alaska and entered negotiations with the prior administration, our vision there was to actually have Mid-American build the Alaska segment of the project, and working with TransCanada, they would build the Canadian segment, and it would end at Boundary Lake, which is near the border of British Columbia and Alberta. We feel like getting the gas to a liquid trading point, the AECO hub, is what is required there and would save the cost of building all the way to Chicago. What is happening in Western Canada, the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin, is production is declining. Import capacity to the U.S. is declining, primarily due to the increase in gas in the tar sands area. And there's excess capacity in existing pipelines going in multiple directions. So gas could flow either on TransCanada's system further east, it could flow on Northern Border, it could flow on Alliance, it could flow on the pre-build section down what used to be Pacific Gas Transmission, now Gas Transmission Northwest. And that's an important point, because 4 billion or 4.5 billion cubic feet of gas is a large amount. It needs to be integrated into the market. If you dump all of that gas into one spot, Chicago, it's going to collapse the price. And by sending it multiple directions, we think that the market integration of that new gas supply will be better. And therefore, the netback will be better. So our proposal is only to go to Alberta.
Second question. Would your corporation look to build a spur to South Central Alaska as part of your project, or would that be a separate item altogether? Or would you even be interested in building a spur?
Yes, Senator Wagner, through the chair. Our proposal is focused on the interstate pipeline. We consider the spur line to be an intrastate pipeline that may well be necessary, and part of our proposal, as is required by AGEA, is to provide in-state delivery points. That could well be one, but we do not envision building that portion of the pipeline.
Okay, thank you. One last question, and I forgot to ask TransCanada this, but it sounds like you have had several discussions with them, and are their permits that they have, are they exclusive permits, or is there the ability for other people to receive permits to build a line through Canada? How does that work?
Senator Wagner, through the chair, they do own those permits. They are transferable permits. The permits are issued to maybe Foothills, or I'm not sure exactly what the title of the entity
I think it's
was.
Foothills, yeah.
But they do own them. They're based on a body of data, of environmental and engineering data, some of which is public, some of which is not. They're based on a body of data that some of which is stale and some is not. But I believe they are exclusive to TransCanada, and a part of our thinking in wanting to partner with TransCanada was they do own those permits. They've resolved a lot of the access issues on the angst route.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yeah, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we could talk about the tariff and the tariff structure. And in the bill, there's a preference for rolled-in rates capped at 15% increase. And we've had some people testify that as you go from the mid-fours on volume, billion cubic feet a day up to 7, some people have testified that the tariff's going to go up, and some people have testified that the tariff's going to go down, more like a J curve, but never, come up above the initial tariff. And has your firm done any modeling on that? And what are your thoughts on that particular issue?
Yes, Senator Stedman, through the chair, we have done some preliminary modeling on that. Assuming the initial size of the project is 4.3 or 4.5 billion, The design that we had initially proposed would be expandable through compression additions only up to about 5.9 billion cubic feet of gas per day. Compression-only expansions will generally be much cheaper, and the rolled-in rate would be lower. Beyond that, you start getting into adding a second pipeline or a loop pipeline, and it depends what increments of expansion you're looking at. We have not modeled expansions beyond, say, 6 billion cubic feet per day. However, there are a lot of elements in a tariff. And a lot of things that could drive rates higher or rates lower. As I mentioned, the 35 TCF of proven reserves that are there now only imply a 22-year life. As new reserves are brought online, it extends the life, and we're able to perhaps amortize those costs over a longer period of time. We've done that on the Kern River Pipeline. We called it our extended term rate program, where shippers came in and they elected to extend the term of their contract by 5 or by 10 years, and we were able to relevelize rates, refinance debt, and extend the depreciable life of those assets. All of that caused a 34% decrease in rates on Kern River. I'm not saying what we'll do in this case, but I think there's a lot of opportunity in tariff design to design rates that will produce a low-cost, commercially reasonable tariff, and we look forward to doing that. Back to the specific roll-in question and how it's treated in AGEA, it seems to use as a benchmark the initial recourse rate and allow up to 15% increase, kind of a lifetime cap there. Because it is benchmark off the initial recourse rate, we think it ought to be any rate. I think it frustrates the tariff design and creativity in designing a tariff to base it only on recourse rates. Negotiated rates are probably more the norm in a project like this or any large project, and we think that there should be the roll-in issue itself is really a policy issue. A pipeline, it doesn't really matter to the pipeline. It does to some degree, but not a lot. And whether that cap is 5%, 10%, 15% is really up to the state. The FERC policy on that has changed over the years. It used to be a presumption that anything that had only a 5% increase in overall system rates would receive rolled-in treatment. Today, the policy is no subsidy, but it can be anything. With respect to roll-in, we think whatever cap is selected there, that it should be off any rate, whether it's a recourse or negotiated rate.
Yeah. Other questions for Mr. Morgan? Mr. Morgan, let me ask you on, let's go to your project, your Kern River project that you did from Wyoming to California through Utah and Nevada. Would you just give us an overview of the business model that got you to this project?
Yes, originally the original pipeline we built in 1991 was really a producer's pipeline. It took natural gas, which producers owned in Wyoming, which didn't have an outlet, and it transported it to the heavy oil fields in Bakersfield, California. That gas was used to produce steam, which was injected in the ground. It was a thermal-enhanced oil recovery project. That steam that's injected heats up the entire reservoir and allows what is very heavy crude oil, almost tar-like, to be produced. And that was the fundamental reason for building the project. As we've expanded, the shipper mix has changed. The 2000 we expanded in 2001, 2002, and 2003. The 2003 expansion doubled the size of our system, and And the market for that was entirely different. It was merchant generated.
Let me back up just a moment to get some clarity. Who built, you said it was a, who built it to begin with?
Originally, Kern River was a partnership of the Williams Companies and Tenneco.
Okay, well, I'm not familiar. Williams Company is it the filling station organization we see here?
The Williams Companies is a owns at the time owns several pipelines, Transcontinental Pipeline, one of the largest pipelines in the country, Northwest Pipeline that serves the Pacific Northwest. They do a lot of gathering and processing in the Rockies and in the Gulf. They own the Gulf Stream, or 50% of the Gulf Stream pipeline that goes into Southeast Florida. They have certain.
Are they a pipeline company, a producer?
They have some exploration and production as well. So they have various business segments.
Okay, so we you were with Williams, and whom else were you with?
Well, I started here with Northwest Alaskan when this project was first proposed in the late 70s and early 80s. So this is about my third turn at trying to commercialize this.
I'm talking about this project that we're talking about. No, we're not to Alaska yet. We're still down in the lower 48.
Well, Northwest Alaskan was purchased with Northwest Energy by the Williams Companies in about 1983. And in 1985 is when we developed the Kern River Pipeline. Or started its development process, and in 1996, I believe, we acquired the other 50% from Tenneco, and in 2002, I believe, is when Mid-American Energy purchased from Williams the Kern River Pipeline.
Okay, but the business model that brought this together, was it an RFA, or how did it come together?
Kern River was just a greenfield project that, through the marketing efforts of both Williams and Tenneco, they were separately looking to develop a project out of the Rocky Mountains. There was excess production and not enough pipeline takeaway capacity. So in the Rocky Mountains, or anywhere, it's happening right now, frankly, if production exceeds takeaway pipe, the price of that commodity goes way down. They need to get the gas to market. Right. So, in effect, it was I can't call it stranded gas, but it was pipeline constrained out of the Rocky Mountains. So
I mean, we would probably call it stranded, but in any event, not in that case. What was the original tariff on the line?
I believe it was about 69 cents or 67 cents. I believe it was 69 cents per million cubic feet, and probably 67 cents per decatherm.
What is it today?
We actually have. I mentioned all the expansion that we had. We talked about roll in a little bit. The 2001 and 2002 expansions were rolled in. The 2003 expansion was priced incrementally. So we have a roll-in system and we have a incremental system. And within each of those, we have 10-year rates and 15-year rates. It's a type of term differentiated rate. So from maybe 33 cents to 58 cents are the differences in rates. The 10-year rates, the assets that are associated with a firm capacity position are 70% of those costs are recovered over the term of the contract. Our rate design is based on recovering the debt portion of our investment, 70% over the term of the contract, and then the period two rates are the equity recovery period. So those rates will step down significantly at the end of the term of the contract.
Very good. Now, as you reflect back on the model that you were describing, does it have any of the traits of a GIA in it that you'd like to share with us?
A GIA has a limitation on the capital structure. That's initially the same capital structure that we used on Kern River. AGIA has a...
What was the capital structure?
70% debt and 30% equity, but we use a levelization model for rates. I don't want to make it too complicated, but there's two types of rate making. There's levelization and there's traditional rate making. Levelization is a process of averages, so that rather than starting with the initial very high rate base, which is very expensive, you use the average rate base over whatever the levelization period is. It allows the initial rate to be much lower, and you do that so that you can gain market entry with other competitors. Generally, if you're competing in a competitive market, old pipe beats new pipe. Old depreciated pipe will generally have a lower rate. So we developed the levelization rate methodology so we could compete into the California markets. I don't know where I was going with that, but there's a lot of creativity in rate making, and I would hate to see anything in AGIA, limit that. I think that we can be very creative in our rate proposals.
Yes, we'd like to come back to the creativity part because we share that. Let's go back to the upfront portion. AGIA has $500 million potentially available for risk sharing. What was the risk sharing mechanism? This is the largest to date. That was the largest project. I'm thinking that Kern River is associated with. Is that correct? What was the risk sharing up front with at Kern River?
The risk sharing was between the partners, Tenneco and Williams. There was not a state contribution to risk sharing in that instance.
Was that pursued? Do you know whether there was asked for a state to share the risk, or
the closest thing to that was the Wyoming Pipeline Authority was formed at that point in time. They were given $1 billion worth of a bonding authority. They had offered at one time to to finance the project using those bonds. At the time, Kern River and I'm trying to recall here, the interest rate they would have charged was very favorable, but it ended up depending on how much gas was sourced from Wyoming. Kern River sources gas from Utah, Colorado, Wyoming. At the time it was built, we were bringing gas from Canada. So the structure they were offering us was, we'll give you a low interest rate if you bring all your gas out of Wyoming. But we're an open access pipeline. We can't really control that, and it was a sliding scale of interest rate. So, if more of the gas came out of Canada than Wyoming, the interest rate would go up. We elected not to go with that state-sponsored financing.
Okay, so there was an offer by, you said, whom did you say offered it?
Wyoming Pipeline Authority.
Okay, good. There is a provision in, and we talked about expansion now, a 15% provision in AGIA. Could you give us your thoughts on that?
The roll-in cap is what you're referring to, I think. As I mentioned, it's really a policy matter for the state. From the pipeline standpoint, we do have an interest in ensuring that the rates, that the tariffs to the lower 48 are very competitive. There's not enough gas. 35 TCF isn't enough. We have to encourage new exploration to fill up this pipe so we can extend the life of the project and get a better rate. So we do have an interest to the extent that we keep the tariff low. Roll-in goes both ways. Initially, for the first B and a half or two of expansion, it will produce a lower rate for all shippers. And then it could turn around. We haven't modeled what the expansion cases are above 6 billion cubic feet a day, but it could go up. I suppose, and you'd have to ask the administration, but I suppose that the policy is We've got to keep, let me mention one other thing. Roll-in is the rule in Canada. That's what all of their expansions do. That isn't necessarily the rule in the lower 48. It's a no-subsidy rule right now. So, but if your interest is to develop the overall resource, having rolled-in rates, even when they're going up, produces a price signal that will encourage production. As a pipeline, it will not affect our cost recovery. It affects the rates that individual shippers pay.
Right. Let's go back to your experience on the lower 48 line. Have you, in your expansions, have you bumped up against a 15% factor?
Let me think about that. I mentioned we have this this range of rates depending on term of contracts to try and make it simple here. Yeah, let's see. Our lowest rate was about 30.
I mean, if you don't, I mean, if it's not within the reasonable expectation, you have it rolled around.
Yeah, no,
your head.
It must be the rate differential is more than 15%.
Say again?
The rate differential between our lowest rate and our highest rate is more than 15%.
Okay, but expansion, if you bumped up when you did the expansion, did you expand to 15%? And let me just say, the reason I ask you that is, to date, at least to my memory, the people we've talked to didn't see any scenarios in the near term and midterm that 15% potentially would even be a factor that we would have to be concerned with.
Yes, I'd say on our expansions, the first two were compression expansions, 2001 and 2002. They were rolled in. They were compression only. That's cheap expansion, and they produced lower rates. Our looping project that doubled the size of the system, we looped 717 miles out of 926. Those rates are more than 15% higher. And I don't know what they would have been had I rolled them in, because the FERC policy today is no subsidy, none, on an inclusive demand charge plus fuel rate. Okay. Because fuel is actually different on the expansion than it is on the vintage system, is what we call it.
Right. When if there are other questions, Senator Stedman.
Well, depending on, I'd like to go back to the $500 million.
Mm-hmm.
Has your firm ever asked this administration or the past administration for any type of incentive like this to move the pipeline forward? Or what's your thoughts? Is it needed? Or?
Yes, Senator Stedman, through the chair, we did not ask the administration for $500 million, although we think that it's a good idea. We think it will produce. The state gets a lot for its $500 million. It gets to control the key elements of project structure. It gets to accelerate the project. It gets to have control of the project schedule and development. It is a big deal to have a mandated capital structure that will not exceed 30% equity. Those are big deals. But it also signals to the marketplace that the state is serious. It's taking a risk. They're going to push this project forward, and the marketplace will hear that message. I think as far as integrating the Alaska Gas resources into the market, that's an important deal, because otherwise markets will go somewhere else for their gas, and right now the only other choice is LNG. We're entering, there is a raging political debate on greenhouse gases. It's pushing everybody to gas. The gas market isn't, they could go to nuke that doesn't have any emissions. They could go to renewables. Nobody wants a nuke, and renewables just can't be developed with the scale that's necessary. Coal is increasingly frowned upon. California is, frankly, essentially outlawed coal into its state, and gas is the way things are going. The lower 48 market needs more gas. Alaska can provide that resource unless we just concede that market opportunity or market growth to LNG, and it will fill 100% of that if that's allowed. There's another thing about that is LNG, once it's there, it's scalable. You know, it's a lot easier to add another tank or another train than it is to initially site an LNG plant, and the incremental costs are lower than what the cost will be to develop the Alaska pipeline. So we feel it's important to get going now.
Is there, you know, there's been several folks that have come forward and testified that one of the things they'd like to see the state show is a commitment, you know, to the project. And, you know, I can assure you the state of Alaska is very committed to opening up the basin and getting the gas line built for the future of this generation and many generations to come. But what other ways, other than writing companies a check for $500 billion, could the state do, $500 million, could the state do to show commitment to this project?
Well, I think the other commitments that are in GIA are also very important. It's very important to have a trained Alaska workforce. We are committed to Alaska Hire, and even more committed if those workers are trained. We build projects in the lower 48. I can tell you that the projects we've been building in Wyoming, I am flying in welders from Texas because there is a shortage of workers in the Rocky Mountains right now. It is absolutely booming there, and that same situation will be true here. So, you know, that is also a very big commitment. Nobody can say today whether this project is economic or not. The last real cost estimate from the bottom up was done in 2000.
Would you say that one more time?
I said nobody can tell you today definitively whether this project is economic or not economic. The last cost estimate, the real bottoms up cost estimate was done in 2001, and since then we've been putting in factors for increased steel price, or factors for a devaluation of the U.S. dollar, or factors for interest rates, factors for inflation. But, I mean, we just all saw what happened to the cost estimate in the McKinsey Valley pipeline. It more than doubled. Our belief, our intuitive belief, is that it is economic. We think the floor gas prices in the lower 48 have permanently ticked up. Now, of course, you're going to have fluctuations due to weather and storage and you know, natural events like that. But you know, what really sets the floor price of gas in the lower 48 is the cost of domestic drilling. That's where most of the gas comes from. 50 billion cubic feet a day of domestically produced gas. 10 billion a day imported from Canada. And the cost of recovering that next tranche of production has gone up. If gas prices fall to $4, people quit drilling because you can't drill for $4. And so, you know, we will present a view to you ultimately that says what we think the price of long-term price of natural gas will be in the lower 48. We will present a view to you of what we think the cost of developing this project will be. We'll present to you a tariff structure that balances, in our view, risk and reward, making sure they're commensurate with the risk that is being taken. But we don't know today. I can't demonstrate to you today that the project is economic. So it is risky. And in order to go into that, actually getting to the answer of your question now, is whether taxes are high or whether taxes are low, the overall project feasibility, the economic feasibility, will take that into account. But changing the game midway through, baiting and switching, giving you low taxes for 10 years and then an unknown after that, investor expectations are set when we make this investment. I am not willing to accept, MidAmerican is not willing to accept, you know, whatever return that we propose in our application, we're not willing to say you can change that after 10 years and knock 200 basis points off our return on equity. When we make the investment, we want those expectations to be known and to be durable. I said in the Oil and Gas Committee, rather than tying tax certainty to time, being 10 years, why don't you tie it to the resource being committed? And if maybe that's 15 TCF, maybe it's 25, maybe it's all 35 TCF. When they commit that resource to the project, they're looking for durability and investment certainty on that. And changing that is a hard thing to do. So what can the state do to offer an incentive? That is one thing.
That's not really the question. Let me just reword it another way. If the state is committed, if the state decides not to write you a check for $500 million and try to come up with some other way of showing commitment, is everybody just going to walk away? Or how could we show commitments other than writing you a check out of the Treasury?
Well, I don't know that you're writing us a check. We are willing to take a risk to develop the project, and what we're looking for is alignment. Alignment with the state, alignment with producers. Having skin in the game is an important thing to us. An earlier question, have we ever asked the state for $500 million? When we came up here in 2003, we asked the state to be our partner. And we'd go without any amount of money. We said, we'll develop this together. We'll be your development partner. That was our initial approach. We were told no. And we went out and we got other partners. We got Siri and we got Pacific Star Enterprises, the native corporations. We welcome an amount of investment from parties in the state. I don't know. The $500 million does a lot of things. It gets you a project structure on major elements that will lower the tariff no matter who's selected. It gets you an expedited schedule. It's kind of a twofer in that, it does attract pipeline investors like our company to the table to pursue a very risky project, but it also flows right through to the resource owner in terms of a lower tariff. So my earlier answer was we didn't ask for it, but we do think it's a good idea. We do support it.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, can we kind of go over, I don't understand your business because I'm not from it, but can you explain to me how your risk level is structured in your pipeline business? Like from today going forward on a pipeline venture, you got to get to open season, and maybe you have a failed open season, maybe two failed open seasons. You eventually get to a binding open season, and you go on and you get your FERC certificate, and then you get your project built. And can you kind of give me an idea, walk me through that timeline of where your risk levels are and where they kind of change, and then at some point where your risk just diminishes and you sit back and work on expansion and enhancing your regulated return?
There's a lot of different areas of risk right now. As I mentioned earlier, we don't know if the project is economic. It is based on intuition that we believe that it is. We're willing to make a bet with a substantial amount of money that the project will be proved to be economic. We think advancing the project to a state where you can actually be market responsive is smart. We do that on our existing pipelines at Kern River. I have 6 or 7 expansion scenarios on the shelf ready to go when the market signals are there. So the entirety of your initial development dollars are fully at risk. They're fully at risk. You know, when you get a certificate, you will have ever since angst in the late 70s, early 80s, that project had capital cost discipline, cost overrun discipline, a formula in the tariff that provided that. I fully expect that pipeline proposals will have a risk component of its tariff. You have to look at supply risk. We have a facility that we'd like to depreciate and amortize over, you know, 35 years. There's not 35 years of gas. There's a supply risk in this. There's credit risk. There's a risk of credit defaults. Many people who you wouldn't think would default take PG&E. They're a shipper on the Kern River system. They went bankrupt, turned back a contract. Calpine, who was up here at least a few years ago, one of the largest consumers of gas in the country, 25,000 megawatts of gas-fired generation. They go bankrupt. They're a shipper on Kern River. There's credit risk. That is substantial risk.
So is the risk linear, or does it change when you hit a bunch
of LTCs? No, I think the development risks up front are very high. Execution risk is very high. At some point, when you have enough operating history, you start tuning things up and becoming pretty efficient, and the risk will go down as time goes on.
Is it fair to say that you have the most risk of your expense dollars between now and a binding open season, and your risk changes a little bit between there and the FERC certificate and changes a little bit in dynamics between there and first gas?
The risks will change, but the dollars will change too. Upfront development risk is risky, but it's, say $500 million, whatever it is. When you get to project execution and it's $20 billion, that is a substantially higher sum of dollars. So even if the risk is different, the risk is on a much larger pot of dollars. I haven't really gone through to try and see how linear it is, but there are risks throughout the project. We need to keep it economic. We need to keep it low cost to be competitive in the marketplace.
So should we allocate our $500 million in capital to the end of the pipelines, pipe projects that are the beginning? Is that a better place to put it and helping the risk control?
Versus
the middle, or should we do it in the opening day?
Mid-American would support it being up front to jumpstart the project, to get the project going, to get the major elements of commercial structure in place and to move the project forward. I think time is an extremely important thing, and in terms of the net present value of the benefits to the state, I think you will see a lot more by advancing this project as quickly as possible.
And then if we were to help you get to a binding open season, how much do you feel it would cost to get to open season or through potentially a failed open season to get to a binding open season? Are we talking tens of millions or hundreds of millions or a billion, or what's your expectations, and that'll help us gauge if $500 million should be $800 million or should be $100 million. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. In terms of an open season, you could hold that tomorrow. But why? People will have no more information tomorrow than they have today. And that's not enough information to make a binding commitment on. So a lot of work has to be done in order to shore up what the cost of this project will be. So we don't see an open season, a binding, meaningful open season, for a couple of years. A couple of years of field studies to validate the project costs and schedule. And then we feel like parties will have sufficient information to be able to make a decision, sufficient information on the costs, the tariff structure, and you'll always hear a different forecast of what prices will be in the future, but we'll have a view, and we'll be informed, much better informed than we are today. And I've heard people talk about a failed open season, I'm not sure where that comes from. I don't know if you're thinking it fails because the project's economic. If it's not economic, it's going to fail. And there are separate provisions in AGEA that deal with an uneconomic project.
Let me rephrase that to a non-binding open season. Does that help you?
Well, a non-binding open season doesn't tell you much. You have a lot of people that are tire kickers and just sign up knowing it's non-binding so they can stay involved and informed on it. We held an open season where we had 135 million cubic feet of gas a day and got nearly 6 billion cubic feet of response. I mean, it doesn't tell you anything. I mean, people have to make an informed decision when they're doing an open season. We could hold an open season, a non-binding open season, and see who wants to play. But you're not going to base any investment on people that are just playing the game for some period of time. So the other way that an open season fails, in 2 years, let's say I know unequivocally, I've demonstrated to you that this project is economic, then why does the open season fail? I mean, people have suggested to me that producers boycott it. I've never heard them suggest that they would boycott it. If it's economic, why wouldn't they decide to make money? Either sell gas at the wellhead or ship gas. They have either choice depending upon, you know, how they feel about the risk reward. I mean, are they going to withhold gas from the market? Are they going to warehouse gas? I've never heard them say that.
Can if you don't, and I don't expect you to be able to answer all the questions because we don't even know what we're going to be asking in the dialogue, but if you don't have an estimate for the cost of getting to open season, could you get that back to the committee? So we have to have some way of figuring out if we're going to expense capital, how much to expense.
Yeah, that work commitments, schedule of when we expect to spend dollars are all part of the application. They're called out in the application criteria. I don't know. I mean, the first thing that we will do if we're selected is a gap analysis. There's a large body of information that's out there, not just all the old TransCanada stuff. Some of that's useful, some of it's not. Some of it has to be redone. But the state's been processing a right-of-way application for this project. The state just completed an environment, not just completed, but within the last couple of years, an EIS on the renewal of the TAPS line. There is quite a body of environmental data, and one of the first things we do is a gap analysis with state resource agencies and the FERC to determine what new work needs to be done. Our engineers have to look at, you know, all the frost heave test data, all the ice damming data, all the borehole data that is in possession of TransCanada. There's a lot of engineering data out there. There was a lot of seismic data that was done. And I know that because I worked on it all. I know what's out there, and we need to determine what amount of that is useful data. We'll have to put together a work program, a field work program, hopefully for 2008 and 2009, and look at what that scope really needs to be. It's not an easy thing to throw out a number. I apologize.
I don't know. I'm just asking the question.
Mr. Morgan, let me give you a break for a second. You came off ski slopes, nice suntan, and I did not describe to you what we've done, where we've been, and where we're going, and I think we owe that to you. You know, we received the bill, we heard from the administration, we asked questions, we had a dialogue, and it was, you know, give and take, and there was, you know, some clarity. In other cases, there wasn't. And then we heard from producers and explorer, and we heard from pipeline companies to include yourself. And then yesterday we heard again from the administration, and tomorrow we will hear again from the administration, taking into consideration what people like you and your counterparts have said during those periods of time, so that we can look at provisions based on concerns you have or things that you think are important, dynamic, cornerstones in a GIA that make it work. And so that's kind of where we are today. And I apologize, we set you down there and you introduced yourself and we started asking you hard questions.
That's
but
fine.
We will keep asking you hard questions. You're doing a great job. And Senator Wilikowski has a hard question.
That's not really a hard one, but I don't think. I'm just curious, if you can tell us, do you plan at this point to put in an application under AGIA? And if you could, if you can, tell us, do you have an idea of who your partners might be?
Senator Wilkowski,
and I understand if you can't.
We are very interested in submitting a proposal. We will have to see two things. What comes out, if anything comes out on AGIA, and how the legislature may change that, and making it more or less attractive to submit an application. Not every question is answered in my mind in AGIA either. We'll want to see specifically the request for applications that comes out, and how evaluation criteria is described. One of the things that we feel should be an evaluation criteria has to do with something that's less tangible but identifiable. I mean, we could go down through the list of criteria and say, you know, technical ability, operational ability, financial ability, you know, low-cost tariff, cap structure, blah, 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 and, you know, you could find a lot of people to say, me too, I can do that too. I'm asked frequently, what do we bring to the table? Because we're not here in Alaska all the time. We don't have a large operation here. And part of what we bring to the table is what we don't bring to the table, and those are conflicts. And I mentioned that in my testimony. We do not have any upstream or downstream or global commercial revenue streams that come in. We think being independent is important because we can be impartial and help facilitate issues of risk reward, of balance between stakeholders, and that is important. When angst was originally passed in 1976, it was the federal government, the president, and Congress who went through this same process of reviewing competing applications, and they selected angst. And in that bill, they precluded producer ownership under an antitrust provision of that bill. Producers were not allowed to have an ownership or management control interest in this project because they want competition. The market structure is to unbundle, not to have vertically integrated market concentration. So we think in the evaluation criteria there should be some weight given, a lot of weight given, to the presence or absence of conflicts, and that can fall under the general term of alignment. And I don't know that that is in, it's not explicit in the evaluation criteria, but we feel it's important because if you're not aligned with your partner, you know, that's a hard way to get a successful project done.
Very good. Thank you. Senator McGuire?
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Morgan, for being here today. And I know you've put in decades of work in this project. My first question is, I wanted to just make it clear on the record, we've had other pipeline companies tell us that they would not be interested in submitting an application if they were required to commit to going all the way to the FERC certificate. And I think what I heard you say was that you would be, and that your experience has shown that there may be open seasons that are out there that you have to go through. But I'm not quite sure, so I want to get that on the record.
Yes. I'm sorry, Senator McGuire, through the chair. There's a couple of thoughts we have about that. I have heard that asked, are you willing to go past a failed open season to get the certification? And it depends on why the open season fails. If the open season fails because the project is uneconomic, there's another provision in AGIA that deals with an uneconomic process,
yeah,
or project. You know, and that might be a legitimate reason to walk away. If the open season fails, and all of the cost studies and market studies that we've done show the project to be economic, first of all, why would it fail? does somebody not want to make money here? But why would it fail? I mean, if the producers were to withhold their gas, then I think it's critically important that we advance the project to certification. And there's provisions in AGEA that deal with a period of time to sanction the project after certification. We don't want to make it easy to, boycott the project and then these guys go away and it's our project again. I mean, that's not what we're looking for. I honestly don't think that if the project is demonstrated to be economic, that the producers will withhold gas from the project. And if they do, I don't understand how they can stand the scrutiny of the United States Congress, the Alaska legislature, having to comply with the lease covenants, shareholders, the public. I mean, that is just a horrible thing to live with, is we're withholding gas from the United States market when people are paying $600 in the winter for a heating bill.
Second question and the final question. It's just out of curiosity through the chair. I heard from somebody at Energy Council that MidAmerica, one of your subsidiaries, owns about 4% of a steel company, and that might be an interesting thing to bring to the table. Is that true? Or do you know? There's so many.
Sarah McGuire, through the chair, I don't believe that we do own any part of a steel company as MidAmerican. And I am not completely knowledgeable on all of the assets that are in the Berkshire portfolio. And so I don't know. I can check. I think Berkshire bought a Israeli some kind of, I don't know what it is. I can check for you, though.
That'd be good.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but my neighbor did, in fact, say it. If Warren Buffett doesn't need tax breaks, why does he need $500 million?
As I mentioned earlier, we did not ask the state for a $500 million commitment. The state is offering that to achieve several of its goals. And those goals include getting the project started quickly, controlling the time, the schedule of the project, controlling the key, what are the most important commercial structural issues. And it is a twofer. One, you induce a pipeline developer to move a risky project forward now, which isn't been it's not happening without it. And two, it helps reduce the overall tariff. So I think there's a lot of important things that come out of it.
No, I understand. And I appreciate you described that earlier, and I appreciate that very much. my question for you, which I asked to two other pipeline companies, is the $500 million, is that a showstopper for you?
I don't think I can answer that at this point.
If it's not an AGEA, are you gonna everything else remains the same and you get your the less tangible evaluation criteria you ask for, are you gonna apply? You gonna submit an application?
I can't answer that right now. We'll look at what comes out of AGEA and what the RFP.
Assuming what you see right now. With your no modifications other than no $500 million.
Yeah, and I still can't answer it. I'm sorry for you for not being able to answer that today.
Yeah, that's fine. I understand. Now, but let me if I might.
What we're really interested in is long-term investment protection. I mean, when we were up here before trying to negotiate this, there wasn't a $500 million carrot that was there. However, a lot of things have changed. We felt like, frankly, we were a stalking horse to create leverage for the last administration. And we are not coming up here to go through another beauty contest to see if we're selected. The alignment that the $500 million creates is extremely important. It's important to us. It's an important signal to the marketplace. It gives the project much more credibility. Whether we will or will not continue to show an interest in the absence of that, I'm sorry, I can't.
You can get back with us on that issue.
It will not be my personal decision, and I believe
no,
that.
I understand. We won't beat that dead horse any longer. The next one, we go back to FERC certificate, because it's an interesting point, an important one, and it's an element in AGEA that we've talked about multiple times. Number one, you said you did not see a failed open season happening unless the project was uneconomic. Is that accurate?
Correct.
Right. So. Essentially, if there's not an open season, you would assume at this point in time, based on what we agreed on, is that the project is not economic. That would be why we wouldn't have the producers there. I mean, why else wouldn't they be there? Is it right? If we then said you're wrong on the economic provisions, go to the FERC certificate, you agreed to it in the contract.
What do you mean to say? I'm not sure I understand the question.
We have
if you say we're wrong.
We have a failed open season. The state says this is an economic project.
Yeah, I think AGEA provides for that. If we
no, it
think
does.
It's uneconomic
it
and you think it's economic,
right.
there's
right.
a third party. And
You say it's not economic. We say it is. The arbitrator agrees with us, and we say continue to the FERC certificate. Your thoughts?
I think we I need to think about that some more, but I'll have to look at that. Some of that depends on what we it's a biddable item, what we bid in the post failed open season right. matching provision.
Yeah.
It's a lot of facts that we don't know. I think we're going to know a lot more facts by the time we're having to make that decision, and I hate to just respond to a hypothetical without knowing those
no,
facts.
And that's fair enough. But it's a hard question, and that's exactly the point of the question.
It is a hard
Suddenly
question.
You look and you go, oh, my goodness, look where we are, and you have to make this decision, but you have agreed to it up front in your application, that you will go to FERC certificate. And that's the question mark. I don't know there's a right answer to that, but it's a hard one. It may be easy to submit an application, but when asked to do it, it may be a tough swallow, is my thought. And if you disagree with that, disagree with it. I like you just as much as
no,
I did before.
I need to go back and study that particular point some more to see what the rights and remedies
right.
are. I don't feel I can answer that for you.
And
right
I think some of your counterparts had some of the same concerns because it's a hard question. Are there any things in a GIA that you see that are must-haves for you?
Investment protection is a must-have for us, to the extent that we go down this road partnering with the state, the state decides there's an easier road, I'm going to just change horses here and support another project. There's a provision for treble damages in there. That is investment protection long term to us. The 5 years to get sanction for the project is investment protection for us. There's not an easy wait them out period, and I think it's a reasonable period, and those are important. I won't say that that's the only way to provide long-term investment protection. We struggled with this in the last administration for a long time. It's a way that's acceptable to us, but I think those are pretty critical elements to us. And alignment. I think all of the people, I'm not intimate with the details of everybody else's testimony, but I'm sure you've heard alignment brought up multiple times of all of the stakeholders. And I think the $500 million commitment really helps align the parties to make this happen and will make it happen in the most expeditious manner possible. So I think those are all important elements.
Okay. Senator Wagner.
How fast do you feel or that you can get to your open season?
Senator Wagner, through the chair, again, we could do it in a month, but it wouldn't mean anything. To have a meaningful binding open season, we've got to nail down cost and schedule and what the tariff will be. And I think it can be done within the three-year time frame that is allowed, but probably at least two. And I haven't sat down to actually schedule out through what we were originally thinking.
Hello.
Sorry, guys.
Two field seasons and 6 months would put us in a good position to file.
Excuse me, Ms. Morgan. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. We got a ring for donuts. they're on their way. That was what the call was.
I think that was the pizza ring, food actually, break. Mr. Chair.
Okay, please.
Go creams.
In the application that we submitted under the Stranded Gas Act, I think we were looking at two field seasons and 6 months to accumulate a package that would be available to file with FERC. Before you file with FERC, you need to hold an open season to try and demonstrate market support for your project. So I'm thinking it's between 2 and 3 years, but for a meaningful one. It can, if somebody says they can do it in a year, I know you can, but without real defendable costs for this project, I don't know who's going to come to the party.
Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Morgan? Yes. If I could, I want to ask you one that came up yesterday, and it had to do with, in the last few days, we had a conversation about this on at least two occasions, and it had to do with customers on the other end, let's just say in the lower 48, as an example, utility companies that would make some pre-purchase agreements. Could you talk us through your experience with that sort of scenario?
I can certainly try, Mr. Chairman. That experience goes a long way back. And you'll recall when angst was passed, Northwest Alaskan, who I worked for, was a consortium of 11 different natural gas pipeline companies. Back in the 80s, we were still bundled. Each one of those pipelines had a merchant function. It had a captive customer market. I came from the Northwest Energy side. They had the Seattle, the Portland, the Boise markets. We bought gas on behalf of our customers and passed that through. Well, all that changed with FERC Order 436 when they unbundled. They unbundled the industry. They separated merchant functions. They separated E&P. They made us transmission-only pipelines. So the marketing side of this has become much more challenging. We had a gas bubble for a lot of these years, and people became very short-term focused. Everything was bought on a yearly, monthly, 5 year at the most basis. Nobody was taking long term commitments, and we saw the market evolve through that. The pendulum is starting to swing the other way as the gas bubble is gone, and now gas supplies are becoming short, and it's kind of like a fiscal certainty. The level of taxes the project can adjust to, but the volatility it can't. So utility companies and large users like Dow Chemical or, some of the major industrials, they want to take out the volatility. So they're looking more today at terming up contracts. Now, nobody really likes to hold long-term firm contracts. It's a pretty big item to hang on your balance sheet, and a lot of utilities will will hold firm capacity back to the closest liquid trading point. It's common for them to hold gas to the Wyoming hubs, for instance. We call it OPAL. It's common for them to hold firm capacity to say AECO in Alberta. It's common for them to hold firm capacity into the Permian Basin or into the Gulf. Holding firm capacity for a utility all the way to the wellhead, that would be another matter. It will require some pick and shovel work to get that done. Marketers might, utilities, I don't know. For what reason?
I'm going to ask you, you have a flight. We know that. We're going to get you out of here. It's almost 6:30. If you would answer this question, and we'll go to Senator Stedman, and we will have you out of here by 25 till, unless you give too long answers.
Okay, I'll be brief.
You'll be on your own time.
I will be brief.
Do you see in the scenario of you get the license, and based on the timeline that you see the project taken, based on what you know today and the applicability of AGIA, that you can go to Lower 48 and get significant financing based on a customer base? And assuming a price of $35 billion for the project.
Do I know? I do not know that today. No, sir. I'm willing to bet a significant amount of money in doing that development work that I will be able to, but I do not know that today.
Okay, no, that's fair enough. Okay, with that, Senator Stedman.
On page 2 of the bottom paragraph, it talks about, in the middle, it says these plus separate inducements offered to resource owners. We're getting back to on page 2 in the bottom paragraph, right in the middle.
Yeah, I have a different version.
Okay, well, anyway, it talks about the separate inducements offered to the resource owners. What inducements? Earlier you talked about the time frame. I'm referencing that 10 years is short, if I heard you correctly, that it should be some other methodology possibly or something. But what inducements do you feel should be on the table? Because earlier in your presentation with the other body, I'm sure there was a dialogue with the chairman there about us being leveraged by the producers if we have a pipe, independent pipeline, and we get into a three-way deal, and they leverage us. So, help me understand that dynamics,
Senator Stedman, through the chair. What I meant by that, those comments, is the other inducements, including the royalty provisions. And I apologize, I haven't dug into that a lot because it doesn't really affect the midstream section, but I assume the royalty provisions of timing of switching between royalty in kind and royalty in value are valuable, or they wouldn't be in here. And the inducements for the tax certainty that's offered. My testimony earlier was just offering an alternative, because 10 years of investment certainty on this project is not that long. I thought that there were some other constitutional limitations that might be driving that shorter period of time, and I thought by defining the certainty around a quantity of gas rather than a period of time might make it better. But I just offered it for your consideration. I don't know if it works or not. Those were the separate inducements that I was talking about, the one that induces both the midstream owner, pipeline owner, and the resource owner, of course, is the $500 million, because it acts to lower the tariff. And so it not only induces a pipeline developer to come to the table, but it also flows through. And it's quite large. It's equity dollars. And, that $500 million, there would be an AFUDC component, allowance for funds used during construction. It actually is a bigger benefit to the tariff than just the $500 million. So that's what I was referring to. And my other point was, it is really the durability and stability of the taxing regime that I think is important, because none of us know today if this project is wildly economic or marginal or uneconomic. And to try and set what level you want to provide inducements on taxes for. I don't know how you do that. But what's important there is that investors know up front, before they make the commitments, what the regime will be over the life of that investment. And what the resource owners are being asked to do, or what I'd like to see them do, is commit the entirety of their proven reserves. And that was just another way to try and avoid whatever constitutional issue was there.
So if this project is wildly in the money, earlier year or so ago, they were using a stress price at $2.50 and $3.50 gas, and now gas prices are substantially higher than that. And at $7, $8, there's huge cash flows coming out of this, at least from the previous analysis that we've seen. So do you feel that the chances of us being leveraged for a lower gas tax is slim to none due to the deep in the money this project is most likely? Sitting at $7 and $8
gas? Senator, through the chair, I can't make that absolute statement now because I don't know that it's wildly economic. The only statement I'm making is we are willing to invest upfront development dollars with the state to prove that's the case. If I didn't think it were economic, I wouldn't be up here. We intuitively believe that it is.
Mr. Morgan, you're on your own time, and we appreciate your answer to that. And if you want to talk to Senator Stebbins about that, we'll do it down the hallway. You have 30 seconds for wrap-up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the invitation that you've extended to us to appear here. And if there's other questions that arise, and I'm certain there will be as you continue your deliberations, Sharon has all of my contact information. I'd be happy to provide you whatever I can.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I'd like to recognize Senator French and Senator Thomas have joined us and been with us for some period of time. And on behalf of Alaska, we say thank you very much for your time. I know you have to catch a flight. Tell your family we appreciate them sharing you with us, and nice tan. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And for committee members and people that are interested, tomorrow we will revisit, starting at 1:30, this location with administration. Time permitting, at the end of that, we will begin the conversation about amendments. I didn't say we would make amendments. We will begin the conversation. Get your amendments to Sharon prior to that meeting, please. And draft is adequate. With that, we are adjourned.